From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2015 with the launch of kind of a new approach to development. Think about the word developer, or maybe think about the word project. In Rochester, you might be thinking of something big, a big firm doing big things. Maybe you think of the Fast Ferry, or the formerly proposed Renaissance Square, or the proposal for a large new Broadway-style theater. Well, in 2015, a group of people came together to call for doing development in a different way. They believe that when projects are smaller, better thought out, neighborhoods can benefit. Everyone can be involved. And here's how they define some of their goals. Quote, "We are motivated by a set of values and principles which mark the difference between giving to a place and taking from it. We have dedicated time and thought to articulating these principles, and as a result have outlined an alternative approach to development that cities hunger for. At a time when development often makes enemies of neighbors, we provide a way forward that puts tenants, residents, cities, and developers on the same team." End quote. The organization is called the Incremental Development Alliance. They have a growing list of clients and cities that are interested in their approach, and this hour is a chance to hear how they would approach Rochester or Buffalo or Geneva or other communities looking to develop in ways that are sustainable. Our guests for the hour include a Rochesterian who put the bug in our ear for this. Glenn Kellogg is a principal with Urban Advisors. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thanks.
Also with us is Matthew Denker. Matt is the developer with LBLD Living. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Bernice Radel, CEO and founder of Buffalove Development. Bernice, welcome.
Hello.
And Jim Kuhman is executive director of the Incremental Development Alliance. On his way through Rochester, so to speak. From where? Where are you going today?
Heading out to Ithaca, Tompkins County.
Heading down to Tompkins County, and where is home for you now?
I'm in Minneapolis.
So this started really with you about 4 years ago. What was going on 4 years ago? How'd this come together?
Well, it's me and a number of other people.
I'm giving you all the credit, I guess.
Oh, yes. Well, I am a co-founder, but with a number of other people, including Glenn as well. I have to shout out to my board chair here, and that's why we're coming through town. The Incremental Development Alliance was born out of a group of disgruntled practitioners, people working across real estate, construction, design, people who are advocates in their neighborhood, people who care about their cities. They sit on the planning commissions, all types of people wearing lots of hats, which is what you have to do at a neighborhood scale working in cities, especially those like here in the Northeast or in the Midwest where I'm from southeastern Michigan originally. There isn't anybody coming in many of these places to come do the development you want to see happen. And so even in places that did maybe have more market demand, we weren't seeing the kind of development we wanted to see. Or in the trenches when we were doing the work, we weren't getting the kind of support that you would see from either bigger projects or a different development pattern, let's say, in how we arrange ourselves as people, whether we arrange ourselves on the scale of a car or the scale of our 2 feet. And so we take as an organization a very neighborhood level focus, from the sidewalk, from the block and lot focus to our work. And that changes the way you look and do the work.
Now, I'm going to ask you a general question because I know, this is overbroad, but well, what's wrong with big projects, Jim?
There's nothing wrong with big. We need big projects. We have downtowns. We have types of development patterns for industrial uses, for commercial uses. What the problem is that we actually built most of this country at the scale of small for a really long time. Rochester got rich at the right time. So did Buffalo in terms of what we see as sustainable development patterns, and that's fiscally sustainable, right? Laying out our infrastructure and our private sector development in such a way that you pay enough taxes so that you can have services, right? That's how our governments work best, right, when those things are in balance. And so big development in some cases, though, in this day and age, has gotten to the point where it's too big, right, too big to fail, and too big to work without subsidy. And so in many cases that those with political power, those who have ability to reach those types of levers and have the ability and have a project that's large enough to go wait 2, 3, 4 years to get through a zoning requirement or to wait for subsidy, you can do those projects. Unfortunately, though, and I'll quote one of my favorite clients in Kalamazoo, Michigan, who is the community and economic development director there. She says, "Jim, I'm bringing you guys here because we have all the tools as a city to help downtown development and to help single-family houses and to help industrial parks, but they're only a tiny fraction of the overall land mass in our city. What's our city really made out of? Neighborhoods, small lots, small buildings, small businesses, right? Small commercial buildings." And so we don't have a department that oversees how well those folks are doing and help them and give them all the resources they need. And so as the Incremental Development Alliance, we're trying to actually help train individuals who want to see that happen, whether they want to be small developers or small investors in their own place. Maybe they'll only ever do one project, right? But that one project, many people working together, helps. And the same thing with the government sector side. We have cities who, both elected officials as well as staff members in cities, who are dying to have the kind of redevelopment they see in other places. But they can't put the pieces together. And they can't figure out why people aren't doing it in your community. They can't figure out why the investment's not there. And there are reasons why. And so we try to help uncover those.
Give me two or three of the big reasons we typically see why.
First of all, we have regulatory environment that is incompatible with existing places that we have. So we have zoning rules in most cities that were written long after the city's buildings were built. And so we have setbacks that don't match the buildings we have. We have an investment structure of capital in this country as well as locally that is largely set up for large master plan things. And whether they're commercial, industrial, or residential, you put in a whole subdivision, we have loans for that. You put in a 100-unit multifamily building, we have federally backed loans for that. You want to put in a 6-unit building? It's only recently, in the last 5 years, really, that there have been more products available that were just as good as a loan you get for a single-family house or for a fourplex, which, by the way, is the same thing. A 1-4-unit building is all available under a 30-year mortgage if the bankers in your area understand that that's actually true. And so those kind of regulatory and financial barriers, because we've lost how to use those muscles, actually. These things have been around for a long time. We're not reinventing anything. There's nothing new here in the work. But what is new is that we have to, in 2019, have to take our existing environments and places we're trying to infill into and use the regulatory and the construction and the real estate tools that we have today to make places that we made 150 years ago.
One more follow-up to that, though. One sort of rather routine concern that the critics raise, and I want to kind of get your take on if this is fair or if this is over kind of done, is the idea that money in politics matters, that developers with a lot of cash can give to PACs, can give to campaigns, and politicians, whether they say so or not, are more likely to want to do big things with big givers and big developers. And that sort of tamps down the desire to address some of the issues you've already raised, whether it's zoning and regulatory or otherwise, that, you know, if you don't have a lobby to push for it, it's hard to compete. Yes or no? Do you think there's something to that or not?
Oh, certainly. But the good news about the rank and file buildings and the people who might build them and take care of them over the long term, they don't need any of that. That's the good news. If you don't build a product that's so complex and so over its skis and so looking far into the future to make the numbers work, you don't need all that. You can actually do simple buildings, right? We define the kind of buildings that we're trying to help with as 1 to 3 stories, probably less than 10,000 square feet, in most cases between 500 and 5,000 square feet. Those buildings don't need a lot of help. And actually, in a lot of places we work in the Midwest, the biggest problem actually is that we tore down most of the buildings and we capped all the infrastructure and utilities. And so putting back a water and sewer line from the center of the street is actually one of the biggest problems. Those are the biggest challenges that a small developer faces, is actually things like infrastructure. Not so much that the project needs massive quantities of subsidies. We also have an appraisal problem in this country that disproportionately affects especially depressed urban neighborhoods. And so when the buildings get built and are worth half the day they start, you have to fix that over time, and that needs some extraordinary resources, but it fixes itself.
When I turn to Glenn, who is now a Rochesterian, how long have you been in Rochester now?
Wow, it's
5 years, something like that?
No, I'm here almost 10 years.
Oh my goodness. See? See what happened?
Moved in 2010.
Okay. So, but it's I think instructive to let our listeners know that you've done work in a number of markets, a number of cities.
Yeah.
Just as a reminder. So
that's most of my career.
Yeah, exactly. So you're a Rochesterian now, but you have the benefit of having this lens in a number of cities. And so what I wanted to ask you is how you think Rochester stacks up on this. Is Rochester a big development town, or does Rochester have an approach that is more in line with the values of the Incremental Development Alliance?
I think we've got some people in town who really are in line with the incremental approach. We also have some big developers, and every town needs its big development champions, like Jim was saying. Like there's absolutely a place for that. There are places in downtown that you can't do that project without somebody with money and downtown is usually the right place for that. But we've also got all these neighborhoods that many of which could use reinvestment. And we have some amazing housing stock in Rochester. And so much of it is in need of investment. And our neighborhoods are in need of investment. And there are a lot of our main streets could use some love. And clearly, even though we have some great people here like Matt Tinker with us who are working on that process and working on the ones and twos, we could use a whole army.
Would you say that some Rochester neighborhoods are neglected?
Oh, I think I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Okay.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay.
Sure.
I should also say that, you know, Glenn knows I had to ask about his recent project just because I'm curious to know if you think Hearts fit into this. Glenn, of course, was principal involved with Hearts, which closed last month, much to the dismay of many of your many fans.
Thank you. Sorry.
I'm not blaming you. I'm saying that you know, we heard from a lot of our listeners who were sorry to see that happen. Was that part of the incremental approach here? Would you consider that separate to that, or you think that's kind of fits?
You know,
what's
interesting. I started that project before I really became involved before Jim called me to be a board member on the Incremental Development Alliance. I think actually that the conversations that I've had with other board members and with people involved in incremental development probably would have taken me in a different direction and helped me make different choices that I think would have made the project more sustainable. But I've had those ideas like kicking around for a long time. In fact, Jim mentioned that we both sort of come from planning backgrounds nationally, and that is sort of where we started to get frustrated with seeing master plans that we had worked on. There were really great, ambitious plans for the city that seemed like they should be achievable, and there were market studies to go with them that we'd hand over that we'd leave with cities, and then we'd see nothing happen. That it started to grow into a tactical urbanism movement where some friends of ours were trying to just get out there and paint the street overnight and make some things happen. In fact, we did that very successfully in a project in Memphis that changed that neighborhood like overnight just by restriping things. But that's where you start to see, okay, what can we do that we can just get out there and get it done? Like, planning is great. It's important to have a long-term vision. But what are the things that we can just do right now? How do we break it down into, like, those really small steps? And who's in town that can take those on? And that's been sort of a piece and a logic of my consulting for a long time. But it really gelled and really came into focus with the Incremental Development Alliance.
We just may have some listeners who think they love the idea of incremental development, that it sounds, maybe it doesn't have the big ticket fast fairy sexiness, but it sounds so much more sustainable and possibly inclusive, yeah, and all of the things that are really brick by brick neighborhood centric. What would you say though to those who feel that way, but then see what happened in Hearts and say, it's not going to work. Like it's not, people don't show up. It's not sustainable.
Oh, I do think that Hearts is, I have two thoughts on that. One, I don't think Hearts should be a mascot for incremental development, that I think it's perhaps larger than incremental would have suggested. But two, there is another lesson to learn from that it's hard. It's really hard. Even the small stuff can be difficult to make work, and there are risks, and we're not saying that it's not risky, but
you also need a neighborhood, right?
Well, sure.
You also need a neighborhood of people that will support those pieces of the puzzle that are arranged in such a way. I always tell folks when they are thinking about retail, because everybody wants a corner store, everyone wants a good grocery, everyone wants a 10,000 square foot Trader Joe's thing in their neighborhood, you know, not actually Trader Joe's itself, but that function,
yep,
that compactness. I lived in Pasadena, California for a while, and I lived through the alley. My office was through the alley from the original Trader Joe's, so I went there every day and like got a feeling of, God, this is really great. And everybody wants that thought process of something that has those products and is local to a place. But when I tell people today, especially in middle-sized communities or communities that are on their neighborhoods are on the way back up again and they don't have the distribution of services they need, I say, look, you need to have twice the number of people as you did here 100 years ago to support these services, right? Because 120 years ago, people had maybe streetcars, That's as fast and as far as they could go, right? They could just as easily get from here to Buffalo on a regional train as they could to get across town, right? Because that's how we arranged ourselves, pre-car. And with a car now, with transportation options like we have them, if you're going to get in your car, you might end up 30 miles from here as fast as you might 3 minutes. And so you need actually way more people to be closely together in a neighborhood format to support the same level of commercial real estate services. And that's always what I always learned from Glenn as we work together, is that the metrics of urban retail and the sort of shed of that works completely differently. And you need those neighborhood services because people don't want to move into a neighborhood where they need to go 10 miles to find groceries. So you have to have those balances. And you have to then, that's what the incrementalism is so incredibly important for, is because people ask, which one's first, the chicken or the egg? The answer is that's not, it's a false cut. You need chicken omelet. A little bit of each is going to get messy. That's what actually allows. Otherwise, you got to do big things in order to use the systems that we have.
And coming up here, we're going to get specific in Buffalo, in Rochester, around the country, and what we mean by that, what it looks like. And because Glenn and I are probably eager to move off Hearts, let me just ask you two more quick things on that then. Does that story discourage you at all about what's happening in Rochester as a larger picture? That things can happen at neighborhood levels, that things can happen, again, not just with incremental, but are you discouraged in any way following the Hearts story?
I'm discouraged in other ways that I don't need to talk about. What I am encouraged about are the still strong residential market, and there still is a lot of energy going in both to downtown, and I think that's going to spill into the neighborhoods around downtown. I think we're already seeing it. I think Matt is seeing it in the 19th Ward, I think there's a lot of energy potential energy around our neighborhoods.
Okay, and anything you want to see go in that old space? Is there? I have no idea, even privately, if there's any discussion. I'm way out of the loop there. You want to break any news?
I've got no news to break.
No news to break. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of hope for that. We're talking about the Incremental Development Alliance, and you can check it out. They've got a webpage that kind of lays out their philosophy, their ideals, their goals. We read some of that at the top of the hour with our guests here, and our guests are going to be able to kind of now flesh out what this means. So let me start with Glenn. We'll go around the table here. You've been in Rochester for almost a decade. You've been in other cities. What does incremental development, give me an example that you would point to and say, boom, that's it, and it works. Where do you see that happening?
In Rochester.
Wherever you want to point to, yeah.
You know what? Even something as simple as the restaurant projects that my friend John Swan and his family are putting together on Park Avenue. They've got a couple of they've got Rue and Dorado, and now they're
Swan Dive.
And they opened Swan Dive, and now they're opening a new Italian restaurant right next to Dorado on Park Avenue. They're doing it one by one, and taking on, like, the space is not large, but I guarantee you it's going to have amazing food. And that, I think, is a great example of incremental development. I think what Matt is doing is a great example. What Matt is doing is textbook. Duplex, cleaning up housing stock and adding to a neighborhood. I think those are the first things that come to mind.
Let's talk about the work you're doing then, Matt.
Sure.
Where are you doing it?
So I'm building a new duplex over in Bull's Head. It's about a block off of Main Street.
Okay. And before the hour began, you know, you talked about, you were telling me about your goal of kind of putting together something that is so airtight that no one could say no to this, which I've never even heard of in development. Everyone says no, or there's always debate. What happened?
Yeah, so a few years ago, my wife and I wanted to build our dream house in Cornhill, and we had grand plans and incredible designs, and it was all going to be very beautiful and very expensive. We obviously, you can go to Cornhill and it's not built there, so something happened. And a little bit of it was the expense, but a lot of it was the opposition to the project. Much of Cornhill is in a preservation district, and rightly so. It's one of Rochester's original residential neighborhoods, and it's a beautiful, beautiful neighborhood and deserves that. At the same time, what that means is that there are ample opportunities for the public to air their displeasure at you wanting to change their neighborhood in any way. And that happened extensively over the course of 6 months. That's not all that stopped the project, but it certainly factored into it. So since then, one of the things I've been looking at and trying to do more of is build projects that are of right. As Jim mentioned earlier, we do have zoning now. You know, the Rochester's first zoning code was adopted in, I believe, 1919. I'm sorry if I got the date wrong on that, but it's right around there. It was shortly after New York City adopted their zoning code a few years after that. And so, you know, one of the things about zoning is that, you know, it tells you a lot of things you can't do, but it also tells you a lot of things you can do. And so for this project, we worked incredibly hard to make sure that the design was not only buildable and affordable, but it also complied with Rochester's zoning in such a way that there was no real process other than asking for permission to building and getting it.
Okay. And what have you learned most from this process, Matt?
There's always something else. That for as much process as there is in place, and as good as that process or not good as it were, as the process is, it's still people who are doing it. You know that you can interpret something one way, and your architect can interpret something one way. But if somebody else is interpreting it differently, and it's their approval that you need, then you're going to be doing it that way.
When you are thinking about the kinds of projects that make sense to you, make sense that you, what you think of to neighbors, you know, one of the things that stood out in the introduction I read was the idea that sometimes neighbors and developers feel like they're at odds. You know, neighbors feel like something doesn't fit, or they weren't consulted, they weren't part of something, and it becomes very adversarial. How do you avoid that going forward? What are your sort of broad thoughts about making sure that that gets avoided going forward?
I am not entirely sure it can be avoided, but I would also like to throw in a pitch here for Buffalo and for Bernice to speak to, is that if you do alter your code in such a way that you have an agreed upon set of things that you're trying to do and trying to arrive at, and it's well done, that I think that can go a long way towards it. You know, that developers will be targeting something that everyone has agreed upon that they like or think they like or would like to see, and because they're going to target that, hopefully, that it's going to work out a little bit better, that what can be done of right is already what the neighborhood wanted to see.
Okay. Are you, you're smiling over there, but what's going on?
Matt knows that something that you didn't say in the introduction for me, but I'm on the zoning board for the city of Buffalo. Okay. I'm the vice chair. So we went through 10 years of community process to change our zoning code. We literally threw the old code that we called the Elvis code, by the way, because it was made when Elvis was alive. So we threw the old code out the window and started new and rebuilt the code to what the community wanted to see. And we had 242 community meetings over it. It was out of control. And so now we have a really good zoning code. It's not perfect. It's not perfect, but it's strong. And it's a good reflection of what the community wants to see. So it has made everyone have hope, I would say, and better access to understanding what is to be expected in the development process. It's written in plain English. Anybody can read it and understand it with a little bit of attention. And so Buffalo has, I'm really proud of Buffalo that we've taken on this type of project. And believe it or not, I actually look up to Rochester's zoning board. I've come to Rochester to see how they operate as a zoning board. Not to get into the weeds, but Buffalo's got a good code, but Rochester's zoning board is actually very, has a lot of integrity. And I've really enjoyed coming here to get inspiration as well.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the Elvis code.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is some risk as a talk show host to going into the weeds on zoning policy.
Yeah, zoning.
It's not always sexy. It's not always sexy. To the people in this room, they're loving it.
Yeah.
The listeners. But you know what? This matters because ultimately it's not about zoning code and regulation. This is really just about how we build and maintain and develop our neighborhoods and who gets to be included and what sort of wins and loses there, for lack of a better term, even though I get that we're trying not to be adversarial here. That's why this really does matter to everybody. So when you look at, for example, the Elvis code versus the new code, which, as you say, after 240-plus meetings, nothing is perfect. You're never going to please everybody. But the Elvis code's most consistent complaint was what? And now, how do you think that has changed?
So I think it's important to say that the zoning code is the DNA of your city. And that's what you have to really understand. If you have a bad zoning code, you have bad development, period. So the Elvis code in Buffalo, and Rochester has a better code than the Elvis code, but it still has some issues there. it was all based on suburban development. So you want to see a drive-through, you want to see a dollar store with a parking lot all around it. That is what our zoning code supported. And you couldn't even, all of our old historic buildings, the reason why we're here for Incremental Development Alliance, all those little baby buildings that are critical to small business, critical to neighborhood development, they were basically all illegal. They were non-conforming under the Elvis Code. So what we did is we made them legal, right? We allowed them to have the opportunity to be redeveloped and do it without a lot of hassle. And so it's been really important to our neighborhoods now that our mixed-use buildings are once again legal, and you can, you know, reopen that storefront and you can put four apartments above it, and you don't necessarily have to have parking because they were built 100 years ago and they didn't have parking. But, you know, now it takes into consideration the buses and, you know, your bicycling and all these other things you don't necessarily have to. So it's a really great progressive code. I'm very, very proud of it. Buffalo took a huge leap, and I would encourage other cities and towns to really think about their zoning code when they're thinking about how to do incremental development.
And so Bernice, as the CEO and founder of Buffalo Development, what's an example of a small project you'd point to that maybe fits this ethos of incremental development?
Sure. I have lots. Right now I'm buying a 3-unit building, two apartments and one storefront, which would have been illegal under the old code. Now I am able to walk in, ask for a permit to reopen the storefront on the first floor. It's mixed use. So the two apartments, those are fine. But it was that mixed use storefront, that the storefront piece was illegal. It's in the middle of a residential neighborhood. It's a super cutie pie 3-unit. It makes zero sense to the big developers. But to the small folks like me, it's perfect for the little pie shop or the coffee shop or whatever. And I can walk into City Hall. I can ask for a permit to open that building and that business and walk out in 21 days and be good to go.
How many square feet is that commercial space?
600.
600.
It's perfect for a pie shop, which I believe we're going to open in it. I already have a tenant. Yeah. So who doesn't need pie? Do you want to support pie? Support incremental development, right?
All right. So I've got a phone call to take. Adam, I'll take your call after this break. And listeners, if you want to communicate with the program as we talk about the right kind of development and what incremental development means, with our guests from the Incremental Development Alliance, including the executive director, Jim Kooman, Glenn Kellogg is a principal with Urban Advisors, Matt Denker, a developer with LBLD Living in Rochester, and Bernice Radel, CEO and founder of Buffalo Development, and apparently the chair of the board of the zoning.
That's right.
Czars.
They don't know
in
I'm here.
nobody approved you to be here. That we always like those interviews better.
Sorry.
Because, you know, there's no filter. But if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, it's toll free. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Email the program connections at WXXI.org. We are right back with them next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with someone who works on negotiating for raises or promotions. And frankly, in this country, there are big disparities between men and women and people of color and white people. There's disparities on who gets the raises and who gets the promotion. So we'll talk about the structural inequalities there, but we'll also talk about negotiating with a mock negotiation set up to show you maybe how to do it differently. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We were just talking during a break. There's a lot of different ways we can take this conversation. I'm going to let our listeners drive some of that because they've got questions and comments about development, what it means to do incremental development, and the approach that the Alliance has taken. Adam in Rochester first. Go ahead, Adam.
Hi, my name is Adam Eaton. I'm the director of Rochester Artists Collaborative. And I'm looking to maybe possibly work with a developer to help develop the West Main area of Rochester. That Susan B. District near downtown has for a while been neglected. And I'm working with artists of color in the community to be able to help support them and give them the resources that they need. I have access to a local private owner who's selling some buildings, 546, 548, 540 West Main, and she wants to keep the property for the arts and for people of color. Are the developers, or are there any developers that are interested in being able to help with that project?
I don't know offhand. You want to start there, Jim?
Sounds like that developer should be you. And that's what we do as an organization. And you might laugh, but that's exactly why, as a nonprofit, we exist, because there's nobody better than the person that maybe owns the building and the folks that you work with in your community to make that happen. And you have, sounds like, several different communities of people you're trying to help that are able to see that project for its best possible incarnation. Don't ask me, coming from Minneapolis, to tell you what's the best building for your neighborhood. That's not going to happen. I don't know this place. I've been here a couple times. I like it a lot. It's got great building stock. I think I know the area of town they're talking about, because I think I've been through there once. It's a great, perfect area. Now, the question is, why you? And why maybe this person who owns the buildings, right? The reason that we train people...
Unfortunately, I don't have the funds to be able... Oh, so I have the vision.
That's
okay. Vision.
Yeah.
I don't have the funds the resources to be able to access the funds, to be able to transform the building into what it could become, you know?
Sure. Yeah. So, Adam, hang there, because I think Jim's kind of heard this concern before. So go ahead, Jim.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the number one thing we hear. Well, I don't have the money. I have a question for you. Do you have the plywood necessary to rehab your building? Do you have stacks of plywood waiting for you to go do it? Do you have stacks of drywall? Do you have stacks of tenants waiting, right? Maybe you have a couple of those things. But one of the things that we hear most often is, I don't have the money. Well, it turns out money is just like plywood. It's another resource you need to have, probably to build or rehab a building. What you don't know is how much you need. How much is that going to cost? And so what we teach in our classes, because as a nonprofit, the number one thing we do is to actually teach folks, train folks, about how to put together real estate projects at the small scale. And turns out that about fifth grade math and maybe seventh grade English allows you to actually put together the development package necessary to attract investment and to go work with your local banking community. The thing you don't have that you need to have to make that project happen is a financial package that allows you to talk about what your vision is. How does that vision make money? Now, I didn't say it makes a lot of money, but it has to pay for itself. And so those are the kinds of things that we would like to encourage people to go look for, because you can do the work. You'd be flabbergasted to see what big development actually does with very, very little track record and work, right? The small development projects that we do actually, in many cases, and help people do, we don't actually do projects ourselves as a nonprofit, but we help people learn through, is that they're actually more sophisticated and more detailed. And many people of our alumni who actually go to bankers and investors, the feedback they get is, wow, I've never seen anyone this prepared. Most people just sort of throw some numbers on a page and sort of just try to work their way through it in the end. Small development, you know, you can do a little bit of that, but actually you know the place so well that there's things that you know how to do that nobody else can bring to that table. And so that's what we encourage.
Can I just chime in here real quick?
Sure.
Okay, so let me just give you a little piece of advice. Your biggest strength is your vision. And I don't know who you are personally, but I can hear it in your voice that you've brought all these people together and you have a passion for what you're doing. And if you can work with that, and if you can work with that building owner, believe it or not, maybe you two can come together and work on it together. So I would say your strength, and yes, there's money, and trust me, I didn't have any cash when I first started at all. All I had was an idea and vision. And so if you have that vision, that is your strength, and you can work together and find the money. I know that that money can be found with the right vision. So I would really encourage you to, you know, you don't always have to be the person with a zillion dollars in your pocket. None of us really are, but there are people out there that will fund you if they believe in what you want to do.
And that's what I'm looking for. I want this artist collaborators lab to be something that's beautiful, something that's available to artists in the community. And I need we love working with collaborators, all people in the community, investors, individual people, small businesses, because we want this to be a space for artists to come and to be able to do their graphic work, for painters to paint, to be able to have the resources and the opportunities to collaborate together. And we need support from everyone in the community. Unfortunately, I'm African American, and I have had some, how would I say, discrimination in my life, and I haven't had the same opportunities of a lot of my other counterparts. So unfortunately, I'm not at this time able to have the means to be able to support this large-scale vision that I have, but I would like support from people in the community. And it's hard to be able to get funding for large-scale projects like this.
All right,
it
so
is.
Adam, let me just jump in. First of all, say thanks for the phone call. This is an example of the kind of things that may be hard to imagine getting off the ground. It's part of what the Incremental Development Alliance obviously teaches about. And Jim, you mentioned teaching classes and helping communities approach this. Are you doing that? Would you tell people on sort of ways to learn more about some of the approaches you take?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do two things from a training perspective. We have an introductory course called the workshop, and then we have a more advanced class called the boot camp. And those basically, the first class teaches sort of the development literacy, like how do the pieces fit together? Zoning, finance, building code, and asking for money, which is tough. And then also the second class really helps people walk through all the steps, the how-to. And that's the number one thing that we're doing as an organization is trying to teach the how-to. And wherever you're coming from, whatever vision you have, we work in a lot of neighborhoods, sounds like the ones that the caller just described. And with the people that he associates with, there are so many neighborhoods with such great human and physical potential, but they've been left behind. And we work all throughout we're New York in the Midwest, down south, and we see the same things over and over in our country. And so we've been trying to, things are a little bit different from place to place, but that training work, those basic fundamentals, then at the end of the day, we can teach, and the one thing I want to say when Bernice says, when she's going to buy this three-unit building, you need to have a vision, but you have to have hustle. We can teach you how math works. We can teach you, we can introduce you to bankers. We can introduce you to people who have money, but you have to have the vision translated into a equation that says, we're going to invest this money, you're going to get this money back, and we're going to work hard through this entire process to make that happen. And so the hustle part I can't teach. That has to come from people who have passion for wanting to improve their neighborhood.
Where are you online for people can learn more?
Incrementaldevelopment.org.
Okay. Got a lot of phone lines filled up. Let's keep going.
Okay.
Brian, next in Rochester. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi. Sounds like you've all done small-scale developments, and you're training people to do more of them. I'm wondering, in addition to places like Rochester, there might be 100 cities and towns in New York State that could benefit from building more of the beautiful kind of places and neighborhoods that we once had. And I'm wondering, what's your experience about three or four things that those local governments could do right now to make more of this stuff happen in their neighborhood?
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
It don't cost anything necessarily.
Yeah.
Matt, you want to go first?
Go ahead, Matt.
Thank you, Brian.
This is Matt Denker, who is a developer with LBLD Living. Go ahead, Matt.
I think in a lot of these places, it actually does come down to legalizing things that aren't. I know a town that I actually love close to Rochester is Leroy. I don't know if anyone's gotten downtown there recently. It's beautiful.
In Buffalo, we say Leroy.
But there's been real investment in the downtown there. I don't know any of the people personally who are, that's not entirely true, but I don't know most of the people who are doing it. But I think there's a lot of great building stock in all of those canal towns, in all of the towns along the lakes, places like Geneva, which I think Evan brought up earlier. And a lot of it really does come down to allowing things to be done. I mean, a lot of these buildings have vacant second stories that they might still have retail, but they don't have apartments above them. And a lot of that has to do, unfortunately, with another really dry topic, which is building code, which some people would be surprised to learn is completely separate from zoning code. They're two different things you're trying to target when you're doing something.
We've had such a good hour, and now you're going to
Yeah.
Sprinkler.
Yeah, no, look, bottom line is, it is. This is stuff people have to know. Communities have to know. Right?
It's stuff you have to know if you're doing it, and then it's stuff that needs. That's where governments can help most, where they can make it so you can redevelop those second floors, whether it's because they have parking requirements that shouldn't be there or could be relaxed, or whether it's that there's something about stairs and sprinklers and all kinds of things that make a building not profitable.
I have a couple comments. So I think. This is wearing my developer hat, not my zoning board hat right now. I think being predictable, having vision, and this is from a developer's perspective, from a community perspective, from a neighborhood level and a person in the community, when the government can be predictable, have vision, have an open door, and be helpful. those things can really encourage. That's not even policy related. Just be helpful. You know, I say this all the time. If you can walk into City Hall and you're helped, you have a better perspective of City Hall. You're more able to ask questions and to feel like, oh, maybe I'm not going to get in trouble today because I did something wrong. Because I always think, what didn't I think about, right? You know, and you never know until you learn.
When and you want risk takers,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
Sure.
Right, exactly. So I would just say predictability is really important. That comes down to having a good zoning code, having a good planning board, having a good preservation rules or whatever your preservation initiatives are. You know, just be predictable and be helpful.
Be helpful. I like that. Don't make people feel like they walk into City Hall and you cannot wait to get them out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because you've probably felt like that in some places.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, Bernice isn't from here. She's from a city like on the moon. It's Buffalo.
Yeah.
Let me get Joel in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Joel.
Hey, this is Joel Barrett from Base Build. I actually know Matt pretty well. We met at an incremental development session that the city of Rochester had not too far back. So liking everything that he's saying, but one of the hardest things to do in development, and I think in real estate, is just being in a position that you can acquire the building. The money, the pulling together, the vision, those are all, you know, key elements, but finding the property in a key area that you would have the ability to purchase, that's probably the hardest thing, is finding the deal, because there is the investors, the bankers, the builders, the architects, the engineers, all of the different pieces to put those things together that are out there, but finding the building and having the vision to do it. And even as a developer, you're not necessarily, you can use other people or investors' money. So that is out there right now. It's just the hardest thing for me as a developer and an investor is finding new property.
Hmm. Okay. Thanks, Joel.
I tend to agree for the most part. I think that there, certainly all of the neighborhoods in Rochester that are functioning is not the right word, but are the most marketable, that if you put a dollar in, you're going to be able to get a dollar five out that you need to be able to pay for investors. I think every one of them are very challenging to break into. Either there isn't a lot of free available land, or the land that is available is either institutionally owned or tied up for whatever reason. I think it's very challenging. And I think you also need to be careful about investing in more transitional neighborhoods because of things like gentrification. Not that you shouldn't. Absolutely, those neighborhoods need investment. We need to be doing it. My project is, for better or worse, in a neighborhood like that and is pushing the envelope there as far as what you can get rent-wise. But at the same time, trying to be inclusive with what you're doing is still valuable.
Patrick writes to the program and says, some of your guests talked about downtown versus neighborhood development. I think it should be a both and. And this is a case where it seems like all of the development downtown is big projects. All of the neighborhood talk sounds like small projects. But why can't this approach go downtown too? Yes, I'm talking about Parcel 5. That's from Patrick. But whether you want to talk Parcel 5 or not, that's the broad question is a fair one. You don't know what Parcel 5 is, Buffalonian. Well, get ready, because we can't.
I do.
We don't
I'm
get
from here.
We can't go an hour talking about development without this coming up. So naturally, everyone knows at this table, I have to turn that to Matt Denker. I want to know what you what approach, as someone who's a Rochesterian, Patrick is saying. First of all, I don't think, to Patrick's kind of bifurcation, I don't necessarily hear our guests saying that downtown is for big projects, but they can kind of address that. What do you want to see at Parcel 5?
Oh, man, I am terrified to go on record about this. I think there are few sites in the city more appropriate for a large development than Parcel 5.
Okay, so that does make sense to you.
Not that I'm saying, oh, it should be a certain project in particular, but I can't think of many places in the city that are more suited for something big. I mean, there's a lot of places for something small, too. I just don't feel like that's it.
Can I chime in here with the big versus the small?
Yeah.
So where downtown development has an opportunity is to make sure that whatever large-scale projects happen, that they are done with walkability in mind. So if they have the right articulations and storefronts every 20, 25 feet and doors and so there's an opportunity even in the large-scale development to make it feel like a walkable community, a smaller-scale community.
Well, if I could say, that was the initial proposal from Glenn's group. I think so, right? The brownstone idea? Am I wrong?
You're actually right. I did put forward a incremental development proposal for Parcel 5.
It really was incremental development.
It really was. It was small buildings. It was in the face of no one. At the time I put together that proposal, the only other bidder that I knew about was a casino. And I did not want to see that happen.
Yeah.
So I put together another proposal for doing small development. I think it is a great site to do large development, but in the face of nobody being able to make that financially feasible, well, you can do it small.
If you can't get the rent, you shouldn't build the building. And if we have to pour lots of public subsidy and funny money and TIF and state dollars and this and that, and I work with so many governments and so many nonprofits trying to put together these deals, it's like, why are you trying so hard? Don't do it so hard. That makes it so. My wife works in affordable housing, doing tax credit projects and all the fancy stuff. And in that, unfortunately, that industry is starting to shrink and starting to get really hard because the dollars that fund that whole mechanism go down every year. And so they actually don't know how to do it any other way, as it turns out. They're so used to the system that we've had for 30 or 40 years. By the way, now the IRS is actually is responsible for more units of housing in this country than HUD. The IRS is responsible for more units of housing than HUD through tax credit projects over the last 30, 40 years.
So what's a better system?
Well, a better system is not necessarily to say that it's a bad system. It's to say that if it's so hard it doesn't work no matter how much extra funny stuff you throw at it, look at it from a different direction. So one of the things I would suggest, and what if I remember correctly from what I saw from Glenn's proposal on Parcel 5, was that it's divisible. If you can make what our ancestors used to do that was so smart is that they made blocks and lots. They devised a system where we could chop things up. And it didn't matter if you built it all at once or over a long period of time. It allowed lots of different pieces of the puzzle. And that's why we have humans built at a 25-foot storefront pattern, because not only was it affordable at the time when we didn't have mortgages and fancy financial systems, but it also is a human pattern. It's scaled to a human's size. And so whether or not you build a large building or a small building on that site, it's been brought up, there's also a thought process about that there's too many houses in this city, right? There's more houses than people, I've heard. I'm working all throughout the – actually, I'm the Incremental Development Alliance is contract with the state, the Michigan Land Bank, and it's 32 county-level land banks. There are 32,000 properties in the county-level land banks and another 99,000 in the city of Detroit. I have seen more demolition of buildings, and then I work with the county and local governments trying to figure out what to do next. And then what they want to do next is largely build right back what they just tore down. So I would really caution all of you in Rochester to think hard. It's expensive to fix old buildings in some cases, but also compared to what? And compared to what was at Parcel 5? How long have you been trying to rebuild Parcel 5? What was there before Parcel 5 was an empty lot? What was in so many other different places in cities like Rochester? And I see this all over the place. So think about compared to what, and think about how can you break this down so that even if it's built all at once over a shorter period of time, how can many people manage it? Because if it's only one mega project, how many people in this city can afford to own what would happen in one mega project? Right, and how fragile is that arrangement to being bought by a REIT from New York City, right, and being owned by somebody from out of town forever after that point?
As Jim is talking about the preservation of a lot of the or considering the preservation of older housing stock and neighborhoods, I wanted to put a quick plug in for the Landmark Society is hosting a preservation conference on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The big event is on Friday. And if you're interested in preserving those kind of neighborhoods, I think it's a great venue, and there's some great speakers. This year is focusing on diversity, and you can find that at landmarksociety.org.
They're on the show tomorrow.
Brilliant.
We think of everything, Glenn Kellogg. In our last 90 seconds or so, Glenn, let me just ask you to getting away from Parcel 5, but taking Patrick's question, what he was hearing maybe isn't exactly what I was hearing, which is that this isn't a group saying, hey, downtowns are for big, neighborhoods are for smaller, but how would you respond to that kind of idea and how you decide what works in what space?
Oh, what works in what space ends up being what's financially feasible, I think, coming from an economic analysis background. But I agree that it shouldn't be in either or, that it's not that big buildings are in downtown, small buildings are outside of downtown. That downtown used to be a lot of small buildings, and I think there's room for I think there's definitely room for both to coexist, and I think that's part of what makes a great downtown.
And I would just piggyback off Jim's point about trying to sort of squeeze something in, you know, kind of the funny money to make a project work. It's the job of journalists to vet these projects and to do better than our track record's been in Rochester. The Fast Ferry, you know, we were riding around on the boats, you know, having a good time. And there were some journalists in this town who did a very good job at that. And there were some like me who could have done a lot better. And I think we've tried to learn those lessons because it's not just about vetting for the taxpayer, which we should, but it's also about vetting for the neighborhoods and the places where these projects are going. Because if you put a behemoth there that can't work, not only is it a problem for the taxpayers, but what happens in the neighborhood? And to Jim's point, how many years of nothing do you have going forward? I want to thank our guests for shedding light on some of their approaches this hour. And one more time, Jim Kooman, get online and learn more about the Incremental Development Alliance. Where?
Incrementaldevelopment.org.
Incrementaldevelopment.org. Coming through Rochester. Thanks for making the time for the program today, and it was nice having you here.
Thanks very much.
Glenn Kellogg, I know we'll see you again soon. Principal with Urban Advisors. Always nice having you. Thank you, Glenn.
Always nice to be here. Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to Matt Denker, developer with LBLD Living. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
And Bernice Radel, I'm not telling anyone who knows you in Buffalo that you were here today because I didn't know you weren't cleared, but that's okay. CEO and founder of Buffalo Love Development. A lot of Rochesterians end up in Buffalo. I suspect we'll cross paths again. Thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you.
Short break, more connections coming up.